Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. And this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Hi there. Sam Wong, professor of neuroscience, founder of the Princeton Election Consortium, and also the Princeton Gerrymandering Project.
So the many issues, Sam, that has captured some attention in the past few years, none has been really quite as important as the issue of race. We're about 50 years away now from the publication of the landmark Kerner Commission report that came out at the end of the Johnson administration following the riots in Detroit and Newark, New Jersey. And one of the issues in the Kerner report, a whole section, is really about the media and how the media covers race. And the commission made a number of recommendations to improve the kind of reporting that took place, including the need for increase in African-American reporters who would have a better feel for what was bubbling up on the ground. And yet here we are 50 years later, where many observers, experts, reporters believe that the media still falls short in how it covers these kinds of issues, whether we're talking about the criminal justice system, whether we're talking about the dynamics of the economy, whether we're talking about disasters, or whether we're talking about partisan politics. And so today we have with us one of the finest journalists on the subject, Tanzina Vega. Tanzina is currently a Ferris Professor of Journalism here at Princeton University. She's been a reporter for CNN Money, and she was also a reporter for the New York Times, where she created and covered a beat on race and ethnicity for the National Desk. She is a skilled multimedia reporter and has won many awards for her multimedia work, including an Emmy. Very impressive. So, Tanzina, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
So let me just start with the question from the introduction, and that is, many decades after the Kerner Commission warned that the newsroom was not adequately staffed or not really well prepared to cover issues of race, where do you think we are in 2017?
Well, we're still sadly very much in the same position. I think when you look at well, let's just talk about the media that we see, the traditional media that we see on television in particular. The majority of anchors, particularly in our in prime time, are not of color or are not from non-white, shall we say. When we see late-night television, most of the, if not all of the hosts other than Samantha Bee, I think, are white men. And so it's not just in our news. It's also in our entertainment. It's also in a lot of the, and almost all the media that we consume, that lack of diversity. Now, that's not to say that there haven't been attempts and changes made. One of the stories I wrote, actually, when I first started at CNN, CNN Money in particular, started out of a Twitter chat that I inadvertently started, should I say, about the lack of diversity in newsrooms. And that was based on the ASNI numbers that were come out every year or two that talk about the diversity, the American Society of News Editors numbers that talk about diversity in newsrooms. And I remember, this was about 2 years ago, thinking, this is the same story we've heard over and over again. And, you know, full disclosure, I am a woman of color, and I have worked in newsrooms, two of the biggest in the world. And so it's not to say that we don't have diversity in newsrooms, but there's still a lack of diversity, a lack of representation that reflects the communities that these newsrooms cover. As we know, the demographics of our country are changing rapidly. And will be changing to this sort of, you know, for lack of a better phrase, majority-minority future. And our newsrooms don't reflect that. And when we do make efforts at diversifying, one of the biggest issues, I think, and I talk about this extensively on social media, is that we tend to create, we don't create pipelines. We tend to, let's look at all of our sort of premier beats, right? Mm-hmm. Your Washington beats, your investigative beats, the people who are winning the big prizes, right, in any medium, are still severely lacking in diversity. And so it's one thing to say we're going to open the doors and make an effort at hiring. And I've been on, you know, committees that are, you know, internal committees that have been formed to address issues of diversity. I've been asked to by multiple people to bring candidates, you know, to the forefront, and I've done that, and I've played a role in advocating for, you know, for more diversity publicly and also behind the scenes. But at the end of the day, we're still seeing attrition. We're still seeing a lack of support at, I think, some of the highest levels. And also, we also need to think about the many jobs that are in journalism. I think often what we see are the reporters that we see on the news, or like the people who are writing the front page stories for The New Yorker or The New York Times, which is fantastic. But those are not the sole decision makers. The decision makers are often editors, producers, senior editors, executive editors. The New York Times, for example, has had its first ever Black executive editor. It's 2017. And that was after its first ever woman editor who was fired. We can, you know, talk about that also and the dynamics of that. And so obviously we are behind, severely behind the times when it comes to people who are qualified, interested, excited about taking on larger roles that have an impact on the media we see, not just those who are reporting it. And so there's a severe lack of diversity in premier beats, in less popular beats like business, for example, who's covering. I was a business reporter. I was, I think, one of two or three women of color in the entire business and tech department at The New York Times. Mm-hmm. So that has an impact on the news that we see, the news that we consume, the media that we consume. And unfortunately, we're not there yet.
And what kinds of, so there's obviously just the normative problem of not having a diverse newsroom. But the second issue you're talking about is it affects the coverage of issues. How does it affect the coverage? Back to my Kerner example, they were talking about rioting and they had all kinds of really interesting discussions that reporters didn't understand what was driving the rioting or why one police interaction would stimulate such a response. Today, what is some of the impact of the lack of diversity in the newsroom when dealing with different kinds of issues related to race?
There's so many ways to answer that. I think first is how we look at diversity and what it really means. And I think often the diversity conversation is limited to one of race. And in the United States, so far, that's often been a very binary conversation. It's Black or it's white. And I think what we're seeing now demographically in the United States is that that's not necessarily the case anymore, right? We've got a very large bicultural, biracial, multi-ethnic, multiracial population here. So how we look at diversity needs to be examined as well. Is it solely race, or are we also looking at class? And I think this is another element to sort of talking about race is the conversation around class. We have seen the coverage of, particularly in the 2016 election, of this, you know, essentially new area of coverage, which was the white working class, right? And that's not to say that the issues affecting white working class Americans are not real and are not present. There have been data and studies that show that this is, in fact, real. But we don't have similar narratives to describe Black and brown working class Americans, right? And so I started writing about those issues. Like, well, wait a minute. Why is our sort of empathy lens tuned a certain way towards one segment of the population, right, white working class Americans, versus another segment of the population who arguably Black and brown Americans have been, you know, affected by economic policies disproportionately, by healthcare, by, you know, drug enforcement issues, by criminal justice issues. And so the way that we look at these different groups is often, sadly, and sometimes through the eyes of the people who are doing the reporting. So if your reporting staff are not diverse, and not just diverse in terms of race, but also those layers of class and race and ability and disability and gender, then your reporting is going to be somewhat, if not entirely, myopic, right? And so to you need people who can, in the newsroom, who can say, well, wait a minute, have we really looked at this narrative? Like, or are we just going to say, oh, my God, you know, the news media tends to be very reactive. So it's, oh, my God, white working class. That's the story. We're going to flood the zone with reporters, you know, in these regions of the United States.
Wisconsin,
Pennsylvania, very Ohio. Reactive. Right. Now everybody's got a presence there. But then what?
So how much? So we think of, and we see every day, news media as being reactive and responding to the hot story that's happening right now. But some of this strikes me as being lagging decades-long trends. If we think about people who run newsrooms who have had decades of experience in the industry, they like to talk about how much experience they have. Their experience goes back to a time when the demographics of the U.S. were circa, you know, Reagan's second term, and the United States was whiter then. And so I wonder how much of this is just, not to trivialize it, but just people who grew up in a time when those were the voters that were in the middle of things. So how, like, is there a way to break past that?
Well, I think, correct, in the 80s and 90s. I was alive in the 80s and 90s. I probably shouldn't say that.
We're in the same space right here.
And I recall a very different experience than one that I saw in the media. I grew up in public housing. I'm a Puerto Rican woman. I went to public school my entire life. I was in the middle of essentially the war on drugs was in my community. It was not considered a public health crisis. It was considered a criminal issue. And so one of the things we talk about in class is actually the narratives that are presented throughout these different decades. So I think, yes, what we're seeing is now this sort of clash of, you know, two Americas or multiple Americas where people are saying, well, that's not my experience. Right. And I didn't, you know, I didn't have that. What I was watching on television in the 80s and 90s was like a fairy tale, you know, to watch like who's the boss and say, my God, these people have a house.
Right. So
and
that's
a backyard.
The, like, at that point, 80-90% of Americans were European Americans, right? So now something like that. It's like a lot,
maybe,
right?
Yeah. But it's not to say we weren't here. So one of the things I think to sort of respond to what you're saying, I think is, and I would recommend listeners get the book by Juan Gonzalez and Joe Torres, which is News for All the People. One of the things, and that's a required text in our class, one of the things that this book did for me, and I think for hopefully for my students as well, was to show us that ethnic media and ethnic press has been here since the beginning. And when you realize Native Americans had a press, there was a Spanish language press, there were Black Americans who had, and the fact that there was this presence here, it's not, what I'm trying to say is that I'm not suggesting that we just sort of showed up on the scene. There have been dual or triple or quadruple narratives about what's happening in this country. Now, because of technology, we can't ignore it anymore. Right. So, yeah. So maybe right. The United States was whiter in the 80s and 90s.
I just pulled up some numbers while we were talking. So, you know, in the 1950s is right. What I was thinking of.
That's
90% white. In the 1980s, 83%. Now, right. As in the 2010 census, 72%. So that thing changes by, say, 2 to 5 percentage points per decade.
Right.
And so yet professionals who are in the management positions are doing something else. So let me just give you one example. We've been talking about white working class voters. This is an obvious focus because, not to go off about it, but despite the fact that actually more people voted for Hillary Clinton, despite the fact that the white working class is one part of the Republican coalition, we hear about them a lot. Mm-hmm. But one of my student projects was last year when I taught a seminar on data journalism. I was really surprised to look at economic displacement, people who are displaced from jobs across the United States. And there's one zone that was really hot with economic displacement, which is this white working class belt of northern Ohio, western Pennsylvania, Michigan, and so on. But another whole belt was kind of in the Appalachians and in the western parts and the northern parts of deep southern states, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia. And there is a lot of economic displacement there. And I have yet to see a story about that economic anxiety. So that fascinates me that there's something that's as at least as disruptive for those communities.
I feel like the narrative of the white working class has also been co-opted for political purposes. And that's concerning to me because I think that the media as a whole tends to report badly when it comes to class and poor people. And they're not considered consumers of media or people who are going to pay for media, which is debatable and we can talk about.
So it's like reporting on an alien thing?
It's like reporting on an alien thing, and you're reporting on it because suddenly it, you know, this group of people was essentially co-opted as a political force and then responded in turn because they were being spoken to finally, right? Most poor people in America, whether they're Black or white or brown, are generally not you know, either treated as well, have as many, you know, opportunities, and don't often see themselves reflected in our media. So to suddenly have a political message that was, you know, delivered to these folks, and again, not to say that these issues are not real. These are real issues. I was, you know, in New York recently talking to some folks that I had met, and they were talking about how many funerals they had been to, you know, of white people who had been addicted to drugs. So these are real issues. The question is just, you know, how are we, who's really benefiting from this coverage?
So how much of this is driven by market considerations? So let's say if we stop and think about whites, whites are also a market. Now, whites may be diverse because as the dominant group in the United States, some with education, some with less education, people in all professions and so on. If I'm, let's say, running a newsroom at, I don't know, CNN or someplace like that, I have to hire people who are going to appeal to a lot of viewers. And I've got this big demographic of 70% of people in the U.S. who have expectations. So how much of that is a market pressure?
I think it's a combination of a lot of things. I think it's absolutely market pressure, and to ignore the fact that journalism in many places is a business that requires money in order to keep afloat. You know, it's not cheap to put people on the ground anywhere. It's not cheap to flood the zone, whether you're talking about Ferguson, Missouri, or Charlottesville, or, you know, Baghdad. It takes money to send reporters out there. And producers and editors. And so there's a whole machine that has to get paid in order for journalism to happen. That said, we're in an industry that sort of has a unique ethical and moral, you know, sort of binding, if you will, that forces us to, you know, hopefully look beyond that.
I've been intrigued by, you mentioned the costs of media, and this is going to go off a little bit. I'm intrigued whenever I go into a studio or interact in any way with CNN or any of the lesser competitors. the thing that strikes me is just how much talent, how much expertise goes into that. And so it feels to me like in those cases, the message is not just the news story itself, but actually the people delivering the news.
Absolutely.
As opposed to print where, I don't know, in print, I don't actually know what the race is of the person who's writing the story. Like, occasionally I can kind of tell from the name, but often I don't know about that. But in the case of a television medium, the identity of the person. So if I sent, you know, you go off to Ferguson and the reporters are all white.
Which it has happened, right?
Yeah.
And so, but the difference is now people are saying, "Hold, wait a minute. How is the Vanity Fair cover all white actresses, or how is, you know, the New York Times writing a story about whatever?" So I think now these things are being challenged. It is, I think, one of the toughest hurdles to break is what we see on television. And again, you don't need to be an engineer to know that what we see on television is predominantly white. And it gets browner on the weekends. This is turn on your TV and look at what we see on TV. So unfortunately, how much of that is the company saying this is what we feel comfortable putting in front of you because this is our subjective view of what we find attractive or what is clickable?
Right. We'd want to lose viewers.
Right. And I find that, okay, well, you don't want to lose viewers, but what viewers?
Right. Well, you said something a few minutes ago that technology is changing this a bit. And so I'm not sure what you were referring to. It could be smartphones, which I think of instantly with certainly coverage of race issues, where it's removed a little bit from the newspapers and television.
You're saying it's easier to get stories, like citizens can get videos?
If you think of the policing story since Ferguson, a lot of the coverage involves citizen-captured video or photographs. And then obviously internet technology, which allows kind of a breadth of reporting outside of these mainstream media institutions that would have been more difficult. You always had like alternative presses, but they couldn't reach the same reach. So how is that all shaping up? Does it have the potential to really transform the kind of media we get?
It is transforming it. The first time I heard about Michael Brown, I was still at the New York Times, and I saw the photographs on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And within a week, I was on the ground, you know, there myself, collecting my own photos and posting my own photos. And I remember one night my colleague Alan Blinder and I were both in in Ferguson, and it was a particularly hairy situation. There was a lot of tear gas, and there, you know, the rubber bullets and the militarized police, and this is all happening in front of us, and we're sort of freaking out about it. But at the same time, the instinct was, I've got to tweet. Yeah. About what's happening, right? So I'm taking photographs of the tear gas canisters and tweeting them, you know, as I'm dry heaving, you know, to try and like deal with this gas. So I think that's one way that it's impacting us. Another thing is there's a couple things here with citizen journalism, for lack of a better word. It's showing us things that in a lot of communities of color have known have existed, but perhaps other communities have not wanted to believe and or see. Now, that also has its limits. We see a lot of these videos. We don't see a lot of indictments. We don't see a lot of people going to jail, even though the proof of what's happened is there. So that's one step, but that also shows us the limits of technology. The flip side to that is that there are also people who say, well, screw all these journalists at mainstream media. I'm going to go out and tell my own stories. And I am all for, you know, the tools being available to people to do that. I think what that the flip side to that is, and I try to explain this often to my students, is that at the end of the day, somebody who's doing that is not answering to an editor, is not answering to really anyone. You know, there are no checks and balances in place for that. So, and I often say, well, that's, you know, journalism is a profession. It is something that we, believe it or not, have to be trained to do. And that's half of what I spend my class teaching my students is how to practice journalism. So I often think, well, it's a good thing that we've got people that have cameras and, you know, can go out and hopefully fill in the gaps where mainstream media, quote unquote, doesn't. At the same time, those folks are not, you know, they're not answering to anybody. They don't have an editor, you know, triple checking and saying, well, have we spoken to this person or is this, you know, accurate or not? And some people might say, well, that's precisely the point, right? Your mainstream media editing is not exactly, you know, getting us the stories that we need either. So, one thing I will say is that going back to the money that it takes to put this together and your question about technology, I recently gave a talk at Mount Holyoke and I asked the students, how many of you have a subscription to Netflix? Most of them said yes. And I said, how many of you have a subscription to anything? New York Times, you know, the financial, whatever it is. And like half of the class put, you know, if not less, put their hands down. And so to me, that's the responsibility of the consumer. The media consumer has a lot of power to, you know, hopefully if it's being used to say, I want this, I don't want that, you know. But if you're not funding it, somebody will be, and it, you know, and that's the person who'll be in charge.
Could I ask, so what is unusual about you and is terrific is that you're so self-conscious about journalism. A lot of reporters I meet just do it day in. No, they're just doing the job. They're doing the next story. But you are, and I've always been very thoughtful with regard to these issues and others about how to actually think of what the journalists do. So you at the Times you were brought on to do that at CNN, you were doing that. What that was in 2013, the Times, right? Mm-hmm. What are some of the steps that you've tried to take or to promote in both newsrooms, TV, podcasting, print, to change the way these stories are covered?
Well, first, by doing them. I think that's, you know, before I was the quote unquote race reporter at the Times, I was a business reporter. I had been a producer before that. So I had many, many, many jobs. I was an editor for a magazine prior to that. And to me, this was 2013 pre-Ferguson. It was sort of this idea that I kept saying, you know, I'm doing these other stories that do have more of an emphasis on race and ethnicity, and they're doing really well, and we're having this demographic shift, and we should really focus on this. And Jill Abramson, executive editor at the time, said, let's do it, and so we did it. So it was the first time I could actually write stories under that sort of, you know, umbrella of race and ethnicity without having to sort of feel like a lot of reporters of color who do, like, oh, this is, you know, I'm just writing this because I'm not white, right? No, this is my job to write these stories. And even then, there were still people, I often say there were still people who say, well, are you the Hispanic affairs reporter? I'm like, no, we don't even have that. But the thoughtfulness, I think, and thank you for saying that, it comes from, I think, the fact that I did not ever assume I would be entitled to do this type of work, right? So I know what it's like to, you know, be a news consumer. I'm very conscientious of that. I know that, you know, I am one of very few people like me often in these newsrooms. And I have, for better or worse, taken on, you know, in many ways the responsibility of not just better coverage, but also more inclusion and diversity efforts internally. And actually, you can read about, I wrote a piece about that.
Is it hard? Could I ask it? And you've written about this. So is it harder to persuade journalists to do quality coverage of race defined as African-American and Latino? Or is it actually harder to get coverage of race as whiteness? Which is a tougher sell? Because I can imagine the latter is just as controversial as the former.
Yeah, they are. And I think one of the big things I was actually tweeting about earlier this week was this idea that as a reporter, first of all, I'm a reporter, right? I'm a journalist. And then we can add on all these other, and I'm a woman, and I'm a this, and I'm a that, and whatever else that means. But my primary responsibility is to journalism. And so when I look at a beat like race and ethnicity, to me, that includes white people. We can't have conversations about black and brown Americans without having conversations about white people. We kind of all live in this country together or not, you know, but even that needs to be examined. So I tried different approaches to doing that. And I think I was more successful in that narrative at CNN only because of the political climate that we were in suddenly with this narrative of the white working class, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, whites, last year whites became an interest group.
They did. They suddenly did, right. And now it was, okay, now we can write about these stories. But when you don't look at whiteness and examine it for what it is and the fact that it is and the implications that it has, so one of the ways I tried to approach that was looking at the economics of race in this country. And I said, okay, well, let's look at the racial wealth gap. At the median, whites have, I think the latest numbers were 10 times more wealth than blacks or Latinos. But 2 years ago, there was 13 times more wealth than blacks. And then what does that boil down to? And so when you have numbers like that, it's very hard to say, you know, one does not exist in opposition to the other, right? And so trying to find ways of telling stories about whiteness or brownness or blackness, you know, as an ephemeral thing versus what are the nuts and bolts of how this is impacting us? How has structural, institutional, and social racism really had an impact? Those are hard stories to tell. I think they're easier, sadly, now, perhaps, than they were a couple of years ago. But I also think when you approach them with hard data, it makes it more difficult to ignore.
Well, that was something that happened. I mean, Julian opened our episode today with the Kerner Commission report, which assigned the the outburst of urban rioting to economic anxiety on the part of African Americans. And I'm just looking at a recent piece here in the New York Times by Richard Fawcett, who's from New Orleans. I was just reading his bio. This thing about this white supremacist guy, nice guy, makes muffins, nice wife. Mm-hmm. By the way, he's a Nazi. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and so one thing that liberals like to say is liberals like to mock economic anxiety as a driver of the white working class. Mm-hmm. And I'm just looking at this guy's life and, you know, I've never met him. I'm kind of expecting to never meet him, the subject of this piece, that is. So if a person of color were to cover this white supremacist guy who I guess makes distinctions between Himmler and Hitler and so on, what would that coverage look like?
Well, first of all, the question is, would it happen? I think when we see coverage of white supremacists and white nationalists by reporters of color, I often, because it's happened, we've had W. Kamau Bell, in his television show on CNN, his first episode was interviewing KKK members. We had, and I'm blanking on her name, the anchor, the new Univision anchor, who's Afro-Latina, who interviewed a KKK member as well. And she's now taken over for Maria Elena Salinas, and she's actually the first African, the first Afro-Latina to be in that position. And we've had Gary Young from The Guardian take on Richard Spencer. So it's not that reporters of color have not interviewed white supremacists. My question about it is, why aren't why isn't that considered part of a race beat, number one? Number two, are we doing it for sensationalism or are we doing it for journalism, right? Are we doing it to say, ooh, this is going to be great. Let's put a brown person in front of a KKK person and that's going to get us a ton of clicks. Well, you damn right it will, right? Like, right. Yes,
but not,
it will.
But not for what's in the
but
story.
But is it journalism or is it sensationalism? And the same question is to be asked about this New York Times piece. Is this journalism serving a larger purpose? Because we do need to talk about these folks, right? We need to understand. But do we, if this was a profile of, and I'm really, you know, scraping here for an equivalency, which is very hard to do. But if it was some black radical nationalist, for example, you know, if it was a Louis Farrakhan or anyone in that, you know, I'm trying to think of what the equivalent would be. Would we, you know, would the reporter have taken such a tone, I think, with that person if that reporter happened to be white and espouse, you know, different, the subject espouses views that were considered offensive? I don't know.
Stokely Carmichael likes to make muffins.
And he's married right. And he lives next door. Yeah. And but, you know, again, I don't want to put those two things on the same on the balance. I'm just trying to think of examples that might, you know, if we pivot and change the race of the person that we're profiling. This came up after Ferguson at The New York Times with the profile of Michael Brown, which was written by a black reporter. And got a lot of flack for that sentence that said, you know, Michael Brown is no angel or was no angel. And so at the time, the Times had an ombudsman, a public editor, who responded. The Times no longer has an ombudsman public editor. They now have removed that position. And so now it's the editor who assigned the piece or had a heavy hand in the piece, national editor, who's responding to the criticism. And I think that's also something that we need to look at, right? So it happens. I think it should be treated like any other journalism story. I just wonder, I think newsrooms are finding their way around this content, and it's serious what's happening. It has to be treated as such.
So could I ask, what was your pipeline to journalism?
Being, you know, it's funny, being a media consumer my whole life,
yeah.
And wanting to be a writer, but not knowing that I could actually put those two things together and, you know, there weren't many people who were doing it. So it's sort of like I kept ending up in that writing world and yeah. Then realized, oh, wait, I can actually do this, and got a good temp job out of college and for a magazine. And that's when I was like, I really want to do this, even if it means answering phones and making copies.
And do you think back to what you said earlier, that ultimately in the different parts of journalism, you're going to need stronger pipelines?
Oh, without a doubt.
Is that happening at all?
No.
It's just absent.
They say it's happening, and I'm actually concerned about the way that it's happening. One of the pieces I wrote for CNN in light of a Liz Spade column, she was the last public editor at the Times, and she wrote a column about the whiteness of the Times' Washington press corps and said, you know, here we are. This very racially contested yeah. moment in this election, and our press corps is very white. And my response once again was, okay, well, we know this. You know, we know this. What are we doing to change it? And I actually wrote, I started once again tweeting, and I started tweeting real steps that newsrooms could take. But these steps are applicable to any organization that really wants to change. And it became a 10 steps your newsroom can take to stop being so white, you know, piece. And it went viral and all that.
Hire more people who aren't white?
Hire more people. I mean, it's like at the end of the day, it's not that
complicated. Was that one of the steps?
Yeah, it was one of the steps.
Yeah, okay, good.
But
yeah.
Don't make them like it was like. You know, nobody wants to feel like they're your diversity hire, right? Yeah, like, yeah.
If there's one hire, then you get stuck. Don't you get stuck with all the, yeah, okay, we need something about Latinas. So can right. you, honey, can you
do go that? Write whatever. The Latina like, story?
It's
yes.
just got that vibe of.
I mean, do you think there could be an effect from the current moment with President Trump to stimulate more interest from reporters, from people who want to become reporters, meaning. Watching this unfold and watching the way it's covered, can in the same way you talked about living through the war on drugs and seeing the narratives that the media used compared with what was happening, do you think there might be a Trump effect that way?
Sure. I hope I think there will be. I hope. I think we're living it now. I think we're seeing, for example, the reclaiming of the narrative of the Me Too hashtag.
Right.
You know, initially it was, oh, Hollywood and Rose McGowan and all of these, you know, celebrities. And then the attention was redirected to Tanya. Is it Tanya Tirana Burke, who created the hashtag 10 years ago? And she's a black woman. She's not Rose McGowan. But suddenly that was a pivot that I thought was important. And then you started seeing her on the Sunday shows and, you know, being the voice of this campaign that she rightfully started. So I think there's some awareness. I still think we have a very long way to go before we reach, you know, the sort of assignment equity and other types of equity that people of color are looking for.
Well, imagine a newsroom that was, I don't know, what's the percentage? Imagine a newsroom that was 30% non-white.
Imagine a newsroom or an organization that didn't leave all of its diversity responsibilities to your diversity director, right? That actually said, I want to hire people who are good and also with an eye towards making sure we've, you know, we've diversified this newsroom. What happens there, and this is the unfortunate truth that people don't want to talk about, is that it unseats power, right? It's really cool to say, yeah, all of our interns are black and brown, right? But if we're talking about, you know, and you can't just have the one person. That's the problem. The one person, like, people are not perfect. People are, you know, they have people they like, people they don't like. So if you entrust all of your diversity powers into one person, that itself creates and perpetuates the same problems, right? Even among communities of color. And so I think, you know, we're very aware of the dynamics. We, being people of color, women, are very aware of the dynamics that happen. Treat us as such and don't act like we don't know what's happening. We want to, in fact, there was data from Lean In and McKinsey on women of color executives recently that showed that compared to white women, women of color want to be in executive roles, want it more than all these other women that were interviewed. So the desire is there, the training is there, all people want is equity, and I think that shouldn't be as difficult a conversation as it's seeming to be.
There's such, I'll say, there is such a hesitancy to talk about race. I find it phenomenal when there's any discussion of President Trump. And this is different because I think in some ways the more important discussion is everything else. But when there are discussions, there's always this hesitancy to just say, yes, this is about race. There's always the, well.
Really?
Often it's, of course, not everyone follows this, or we don't know, or there's other reasons. And there's an article in The Atlantic, The Nationalist Delusion, that just came out. And it's quite powerful, challenging the whole narrative that this was really about white working class economic interests. And in fact, that a lot of mainstream commentators had trouble just explicitly talking about the role of race and whiteness in this candidacy.
Because they feel implicated
in the election.
Right. And so there's this the thing about race, and when we talk about racism in the United States, it often is, people take it as a very individual failing, right? They feel directly implicated. If they say, oh, all these people voted for Trump, that means, you know, in some way, shape, or form, maybe I'm, you know, also part of this group, or I represent what have you. And I think that the onus on owning this has to be on white Americans, too. I mean, you know, I give talks often, and I've told during these talks, I've said, you know, you guys have access to research.
Yeah.
We know the history of this country. Like, to act as though that hasn't had an impact on us is insane. And it's on reporters to do that. But it's also on editors to say, okay, we're going to report this out the way we would any other story, and we're not going to be afraid of that. Right. And unfortunately, that's not where we are when it comes to race.
We're almost out of time, but you're working on a book now.
Yes.
What's the project on?
Oh, you know, little topic of women of color in the United States. The book is called Uppity. It's looking at the opportunities and challenges that women of color as a collective are facing and will continue to face going into the next decade. As a woman of color myself, who's worked in, you know, different, some of the biggest newsrooms in the world and came from this sort of very different background, that I know that I'm not the only professional woman of color who's had similar experiences of being paid less or, you know, struggles in personal relationships, for example. And so these are issues that I think often don't get explored as a whole. And I think when we look at the data, we look at the numbers of the demographics, there will be more women of color than white women in the next couple of decades. So the big question that I'm exploring is this notion of having it all. When we hear it from, you know, often white feminists, right? Does that notion trickle down to us? And it doesn't. I mean, the truth is it doesn't, right? And when I say us, I'm obviously talking about women of color. So Black women, Latina women, Asian and Native American women. We all face different challenges. We all face unique challenges. This isn't to say we're all one, you know, monolithic group. But as a group, when you look at, again, when you look at data, you notice trends and our well-being, whether it's, you know, physical, mental, economic, and social, is pretty limited in the United States. And yet here we are poised to become a majority. And so there are lots of issues at this intersection that I think have been ignored by feminists, largely by white feminists, right? When we lean in, and I think Sheryl Sandberg's book was fantastic, but for women of color who didn't have, you know, the right connections or the right whatever, leaning in for us can be taken as aggressive or angry or any of these other things.
So it's having it all versus having our share.
Having our share. Yeah. And also, hey, wait a minute. Why, you know, why is this still happening to us? You know, when we're going to school and getting degrees in levels that are unprecedented, at the same time we're holding down families and there's just a whole world that isn't being talked about and starting to become that way in this sort of post-Women's March world that we're living in. But even within that, we're still seeing unique issues affecting women of color.
I wonder, as you teach here at Princeton, you're in residence here. Princeton has become a more diverse place in the last 10, 15 years or so. So I'd be fascinated to hear about what your students are saying. Kind of curious about that.
About me, about the school, about?
Either about the school or about these issues of diversity as Princeton itself becomes a more diverse place.
Well, I will say this. I love my students genuinely. I'm so excited to be here. I did say that everything we talk about in class would be off the record. So I want to respect that. But I will say in terms of my teaching and what we're learning in class, one of the big issues for me is really breaking the students out of an academic framework and into a journalistic one. And then how, so we're looking at a bunch of different things. We're looking at who covers the stories, the business of journalism, how business impacts all of this, the narratives that we see being created. So today in class, we'll be talking about the Nazi next door article in the New York Times. We're into set part two of white nationalism and how it's covered.
Muffins.
Muffins. Lots of muffins. They're aware. They're very smart. They're eager. But they're also, I think, finally beginning to realize the difference between editorializing and journalism, between dogma and journalism. And I want them to. And if they walk away with that, I'll be just delighted.
Well, we're very fortunate to have you here for this year as, Ferris Professor of Journalism, Tanzina Vega, who's worked for The New York Times, worked for CNN, and now is also writing a book called Uppity, which we're looking forward to. So thanks so much for joining the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, that wraps up our episode, and thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Take care, everybody. Bye.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.